here with us for the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about reading to children.
A mother's voice can wrap us in warm blankets. It can guide gently or yank us back from the cliff. And sometimes it can take us places we only dreamed were possible. Jan Larson and her three grown children remember a mother's voice.
Our children are grown. The magic is packed in cardboard boxes and tucked away in the loft, waiting for the next generation to reveal its secrets. The snuggler, an oversized chair that once cradled the Larsons five each night before sleep claimed our three young ones, sits empty in the corner of our living room. But once upon a time, those twilight hours held the promise of adventure, of magic, of silly laughter, as my husband and I beckoned our pajama-clad pirates to join us in the joy of reading. And when the clamor for, "Just one more, Mommy," rang out, I didn't mind a bit.
Dina, what do you remember about being read to as a child?
You did voices. And now whenever I read to friends or loved ones, I do voices. And it makes all the difference. It's even more immersive. And it's funny because just like I associate certain characters in some of my favorite stories from my childhood with you, some of the favorite characters in stories that I've shared with friends or loved ones since then are now associated with my voice and my mannerisms.
Gray, what are you thinking about? How did reading make you feel?
I just wanted to speak to what Dana said, because Dana and I read together, and I read sometimes, but most often I like when Dana reads because he's better at the voices.
Ellie, what do you remember about the Larsons Five reading together at night?
We were living on our sailboat together and found a copy of the seventh Harry Potter book. And by that time, two of us were teenagers already, but we still loved having you read to us. And we made you read that book for hours on end because we were so desperate to hear more of the story. And I couldn't get our hands on enough copies for all of us to have separately. And I remember you begging us to let you take a break so that you could get food and some water.
Yes, I remember that very well. And then what did you do that night after I'd gone to bed? Because I went to bed with the book and hid it under my pillow.
Well, your point was to make it fair so that nobody could read ahead. But I snuck it out from under your pillow and stayed up all night reading it.
I distinctly remember being at the end of a chain of theft. Ellie would steal the book from Mom and read it, and then Gray would procure the book from Ellie and read it. And the whole time that they were reading it would be pouting at them disapprovingly, saying, "You're not supposed to be reading ahead, okay? This is for Mom to read."
What he meant was, we weren't supposed to be reading ahead of Dana.
Yeah, not without me.
Do you think ahead to maybe having your own families and what you'll do then?
Yes, bring them over so that you can read to them too.
I'll be happy to. I will be happy to. And then it will be a grandmother's voice. That will be a fun thing.
Well, you're going to have to wait a while for that. That's not coming anytime soon.
That's okay. That'll be worth the wait. Thanks so much. It is always a pleasure to get to read to you, and I hope that you have good memories of feeling warm and loved.
We always do.
They're all of the best memories.
You gave us all the good things that we have.
Oh, I love you, kids.
Love you, Mom.
We love you, Mom.
Aren't you going to say your signature line?
Oh. Thanks for making us.
And they all lived happily in harmony and peace ever after.
Writer Jan Larson is the chair of the Communication and Journalism Department at UW-Eau Claire. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lola and Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Maureen McCollum.
It's the Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Now to a pair of remote-controlled sail drones launched on Lake Superior, gathering fish data around the clock. Picture one long single hull, bright orange, with this tall, hard wing jutting up from its center with a spar running lengthwise. And they're powered by wind and solar, made by a California firm called Sail Drone. And it's the first use of them on Lake Superior. Join in on fish surveys and these uncrewed vessels, 800-642-1234. Peter Esselman is a research fishery biologist at the U.S. Geological Survey and primary investigator for a three-year study of fish populations in the Great Lakes using uncrewed sailing vessels and autonomous underwater vehicles. Peter, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you, Kate. Good morning.
So, good morning. You launched them near the Apostle Islands last week. Where are they now?
The two sail drones have went west for a while around the Apostles and towards Duluth, and then they crossed the lake to the north, and now they're on the north shore of Lake Superior in Minnesota waters.
Okay, so now they're at our neighbor's side.
That's correct. But they'll be zigzagging through the western arm of Lake Superior, and eventually will enter Canadian waters and then cross south around Isle Royale and then back home to Ashland.
I gave my best shot at describing what they look like. Do you have any ways that you like to depict them or describe them?
They're basically large orange sailboats that are remotely helmed. So there's someone in at a base station in California that is monitoring their progress and issuing routes and commands to them. It's basically a rigid sailboat that's covered with solar panels.
Hmm. I would imagine you'd be like a kid in a candy store flooded with all this new data and, you know, so much of it. Can you explain what information you're gathering here about Lake Superior?
Absolutely. So I'll give you a little bit of background. So the Great Lakes commercial and recreational fishery is extremely valuable to coastal communities and really to all the Great Lakes states. Fishery Commission has estimated that the Great Lakes economy generates $7 billion per year just from the lakes alone and provides over 75,000 jobs. The fishery is actively managed by the Great Lakes Council of Lake Committees, which is basically a group made up of the states, the tribes, and the province of Ontario, and it's also convened by a group called the Great Lakes Fishery Commission. So every year, these lake committees on each lake make decisions about quotas and seasons and catch limits and size limits, and they use data to support their decision making. And USGS is one of the organizations, the longest running organization, providing data to support those decisions. So typically, we do our work with large research vessels. We tow nets through the water, and we use scientific echo sounders, which are basically powerful fish finders. And the quality of the data that we provide to the lake managers essentially affects the quality of their decisions they can make downstream. So if our estimates are low, it's possible that the quotas they set will be low. So the study that we're carrying out with these advanced survey technologies that are essentially being brought here from ocean environments, the purpose of the study is really to evaluate the accuracy of the estimates of fish abundances that we're providing to our management partners, and comparing the data that come from these new instruments to our conventional large vessel surveys.
So, as you said there, these were designed for long-range ocean science missions. Do you find this new technology compatible to lake missions, or are there some necessary adjustments that you need to make?
These technologies are extremely compatible to the Great Lakes. These are inland seas more than they're considered lakes, in my opinion. You know, the sail drone is a technology that can go out for months at a time, and so it offers us the potential in the future, you know, to essentially collect data 24/7 from ice off to ice on. And then there's other technologies that we're using to also assess fisheries and try to get a better handle on how accurate our numbers are.
So as this technology is being used until, is it end of September? Is it, when they finish up there was? Yeah,
this mission will be through the end of the first week of September.
Okay, and then are the traditional trawling boats collecting fish data at the same time?
That's correct. So we've been able to work very closely with the states of Minnesota and the state of Wisconsin, the Red Cliff Band and the Grand Portage Band of Chippewa Indians, and the Fish and Wildlife Service, as well as the province of Ontario, to get 6 different research vessels on the water at the same time to collect comparative data in the same water on the same night as these silenced fisheries data collection vehicles. And the idea is that what we're doing is we're comparing echo sounder based estimates of fish abundance that are coming from a platform, these sail drones, that is completely silent, to the numbers that are coming from vessels that produce noise and potentially scare fish away from the location where we're doing our census work. So in working with our partners, we're going to amass a large data set that will help us understand to what extent noise affects our abundances, whether noise, for instance, leads to lower abundance estimates, which, as I mentioned earlier, might have some downstream impacts on decision making.
Do you know at all how noise affects fish? I mean, going into this comparison contrast type of experiment, what do you know about noise?
Sure. So there's been a number of studies around the world. This is a topic that's been studied more extensively in an ocean environment. And it's clear from the literature that in many cases, fish do avoid noise propagated from large research vessels in the upper part of the water column. And they tend to flee away and down from the location of the noise production, i.e. in our case, twin diesel engines on our 107-foot research vessel, Kaiai. There's another source of bias that isn't directly related to noise, which is that our echo sounders are deployed about 15 feet down into the water, basically at the bottom of the vessel. And so whatever fish are occurring in the upper water column are also missed. And there's been 2 powerful studies in the Great Lakes, including one in Lake Superior, showing that by not accounting for fish at the water surface, you end up coming up with 2 to 3 times low estimates of how many fish are actually in the water. And so in addition to these sail drones, we've embraced a technology that was developed by the Monterey Aquarium Research Institute. And this is a midwater, like an underwater autonomous vehicle that has uplooking fish finders that essentially allows us to count fish at the surface. And so we're also comparing our data from vessels to these uplooking echo sounders in these long range autonomous underwater vehicles. So we just completed a 2-week mission with one of those, and that autonomous underwater vehicle is now moving to Lake Michigan.
This is like no fish left behind.
I mean, that's certainly what the trend seems to be. These technologies really give us a order of magnitude greater information. It's sort of entering the big data era here.
USGS research fishery biologist Peter Esselman with us, lead scientist on this 3-year study with sail drone fish population data collection, comparing it to how they're collecting this data now. Join in on Acoustic Echo Fish Finders, your observations about the Lake Superior fish population, curiosities about the sail drone technology and how it works, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Glad you could join us. We are exploring this pair of uncrewed sail drones that have set sail in Lake Superior near the Apostle Islands and what these boats may tell scientists about the accuracy of understanding the Great Lakes fish population. Join in on the science of counting fish in the Great Lakes, what this technology will do for scientists, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. We have USGS research fishery biologist and project lead Peter Esselman, who stays with us. So, Peter, they have this onboard computer so that they can navigate the waypoints. So how do the sail drones handle extreme weather, and what happens if they're caught in a storm?
So SailDrone has protocols for dealing with extreme weather. One of those is to essentially let the sail, the rigid sail, go limp, and essentially it'll avoid tipping over and damage. It's essentially at that point it becomes a floating buoy. SailDrone is a company that has actually recently gained accolades for sending a slightly modified version of the drone that we have out into the eye of a category 4 hurricane in the Atlantic Ocean. And so these are very robust science instruments, and they're not very prone to, tipping or capsizing.
Wow, that's amazing. Let's bring on a caller now. Emily is with us from Milwaukee. Emily, hi.
Good morning. I just had a question about how this guest thinks or anticipates this data is used, and specifically whether you view your job or collecting the data as more in the service of conservation interests or more in the interest of recreational fishing. And kind of relatedly, do you think the danger is greater that you are going to over or underestimate the number of fish with this technology?
Great questions, Emily. The diverging interests there. Go ahead, Peter.
Absolutely. So the fisheries management community is concerned certainly with maximizing the benefit of the fishery to the public. And but there's also a large concern with restoring native species, and there's been a concerted 50-year effort at, for instance, restoring lake trout populations, which are native to the Great Lakes. And there's also an ongoing startup effort to restore lake herring and other species related to them into the lower Great Lakes below Lake Superior. And so, USGS as a science organization is really responding to the needs of our partners for data. And the need that they've identified is to understand how many prey fish are out there in the lake, prey fish being kind of the bait that support the predator stocks. I believe that there's a chance, especially with the uplooking echo sounder, we will see slightly increased estimates of abundance, and maybe even drastically increased estimates of abundance. Our data sets currently span 44 years in Lake Superior, 48, 49 years in Lake Michigan, and they're consistent internally because we've used the same methods the whole time. But all gear types have biases, and the biases that we're trying to control this summer are likely to give us higher estimates of abundance.
So, with those higher estimates of abundance, you can take that really good data and put it to use in a commercial aspect for fishing, but also in a conservation aspect. How could those two different interests both be fueled by this data?
Absolutely. So let me give you a concrete example. So the Lake Superior Committee sets quotas for harvest of lake herring, which is fished for its roe. This is also called Cisco in Lake Superior. And essentially, they use our estimates of abundance and other data streams coming from the states and the tribes to consider a sustainable harvest levels. And so, in that case, you can see it as focused on both sustainability, which is a conservation concept that's important, but also on harvest and sustaining an economy around that fishery. There's a similar effort for lake trout harvest. For instance, Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources considers our data to set quotas for harvest and also bag limits, which essentially define the number of fish and the size of the fish that can be taken by anglers. And so, in every case, my observation is that the lake committees that are setting these targets are considering the long-term sustainability of the fishery, not so much just maximizing profit. Of course, there's always pressure to allow more fishing and higher quotas, but my observation is that sustainability is a central concept to what the managers are doing with the data we provide them.
Talking with USGS research fishery biologist Peter Esselman. Going to John now in Boaz with a question. John, hi.
Good morning. I was wondering if your database has a category for Asian carp, and how are they doing?
Peter, go ahead on Asian carp and whether it tracks something like that.
Sure, John, thanks for your question. Fortunately, we have not encountered Asian carp in the open lake environment. My understanding is that there is a there's a very small population of Asian carp that have established in the St. Joe's River, which is on the southeastern side of Lake Michigan. There's a very robust monitoring and response network that's been put in place with leadership from the Fish and Wildlife Service and Army Corps of Engineers. Fortunately, we're not seeing Asian carp in our large lake data, and you know, hopefully it remains that way.
Oh, that's great news. We only have a few seconds left, Peter. What are you watching for as this data collection continues?
We're really watching for ideal weather windows to get these our traditional crewed vessels out there with these sail drones, so that we can get the best possible comparative data. Data really is what drives our work, and it's what drives the best decision making. And so that's really what we're pushing for here, and that's why we're adopting these new technologies.
Peter, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Peter Esselman, research fishery biologist with the U.S. Geological Survey, lead scientist on this three-year study of fish populations in the Great Lakes. Just ahead, we talk with an expert on making end-of-life plans. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.